5-207, Mike D. Hennig and Hennig Furs versus Amazon.com Inc. et al. We'll have counsel for the appellant. I understand we have Mr. Godfrey, and that out of your 10 minutes allocated to the appellant, you would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Is that right? You may proceed. Let's just make sure the microphone is working. Would you just tap that? Let's just ask if there's someone who can help us with the technical difficulties, because we do record these and make all of the arguments available for streaming afterwards on our website. So how is it now?
I think it's fine, Your Honor. It's
okay. Working. That sounds good. All right. So, Mr. Godfrey, you may proceed.
May it please the court. As you know, I'm Richard Godfrey. I represent Hennig Furs and Mike Hennig, the current owner of the company. We're here on a motion to dismiss order that was granted with respect to a Reverse False Claims Act. But the issue on this appeal is an overarching, fundamental one with profound implications far beyond this particular case. Simply stated, it can be described as follows. Can defendant Amazon evade and avoid any legal responsibility whatsoever for inducing, indeed causing, foreign importers to use its transportation, logistics, warehousing, marketing, customer service, collection, communications systems and facilities, invoicing, to import products into this country in violation of U.S. laws? We submit that the answer has to be no, for otherwise criminals, even foreign adversaries, can freely and without fear of detection illegally import not just furs, but drugs, weapons, virtually anything, to the detriment not just of American businesses like Hennig Furs, a small furrier based in the southeast of this country, but to the detriment of American businesses in general and, frankly, our foreign security. Significantly, Amazon never once denies that various foreign importers routinely and for years has used its marketplace, the marketplace it created, to illegally import fur products. But its position, adopted by the district court, is that Hennig's Second Amendment complaint fails to allege facts giving rise to any plausible claim of import fraud or that Amazon caused it.
So, Mr. Godfrey, if you could address that. I understand, as you framed it, that the question is whether the allegations in the Second Amended complaint are sufficient to survive a motion to dismiss. That's the posture we're in, correct?
That is correct.
So could you tell us, because I understand here, the only person that your clients have sued, or Amazon, you're not suing the Chinese companies that have imported the furs or failed in your allegations to declare them for customs purposes. Is that correct?
That is correct also.
So could you walk us through what you just described as the theory, or one of the theories, that Amazon caused these importing companies to fail to declare and pay duties?
Sure. The causation theory is actually quite specific. The test, this court has never adopted the test formally, but the Third Circuit test, which most courts have adopted out of the Zimmer case, is whether or not it's a substantial factor. It's common law causation, whether or not it's a substantial factor. And so the question is, was Amazon a substantial factor in inducing? And the answer is yes. We've identified numerous things that Amazon did and did not do that induced the foreign importers to use its facilities in concert with it. 15 years of import fraud, actual knowledge of import fraud by Amazon.
Could you pause on that one?
I'd love to.
Show us, and if you could be specific with the paragraphs in the complaint.
40.
Paragraph 40?
Customs declaration form. The complaint is replete with them, but 40 is a good example. Every package that arrives at an Amazon warehouse has a customs declaration form. The customs declaration form says, not furs, it says children's clothes. It says polyester clothes. And yet it's furs.
Now, let's pause there, because the question is whether Amazon caused that to happen.
Correct.
Paragraph 40 says that Amazon's co-conspirators also prepared and attached to the packages containing the furs false customs declarations. And I understand that part of your claim,
right?
That Amazon didn't prepare that. So
but the,
you connect that to the causation by Amazon.
Right. Substantial factor. Amazon has created an open marketplace that is unregulated, unmonitored, and it tests nothing. And in the state of Washington, the attorney general went after them over the importation of children's toys, which had hazardous chemicals in it. And on May the 9th, 2019, Amazon entered into an assurance of discontinuance. And in that assurance of discontinuance, Amazon took the simple steps of requiring certified tests.
I'm sorry, is that in the complaint, or is that something you want us to take judicial notice of?
Judicial notice of, Your Honor. We addressed that point on page 8.
Yeah, could we focus for the moment? I wear you raised that in the brief. Could you focus, though, on the allegations in the complaint? Because that's our primary focus. Where in the complaint you allege some actions by Amazon that, in your view, trigger causation by Amazon?
What we said was Amazon received the goods with knowledge, actual knowledge, or deliberate ignorance.
No, that's what I'm asking you. The allegations that establish knowledge. I understand you're arguing knowledge, but that's a conclusory allegation just to say they had knowledge. So
the allegations
are
the declaration form, which says something other than FERS, the lack of a form 3177, the lack of monitoring, lack of oversight, the fact that Mr. Hennig put them on notice in this complaint. Mr. Hennig went and purchased furs, came through Amazon, but they weren't marked furs. They were marked as children's clothes.
How did that put Amazon on notice, counsel? Just the fact that your client utilized Amazon services to order the furs and it didn't have the form, how would that have put Amazon on notice of your claim?
Amazon, when it received the complaint back in 2023,
right,
was put on notice at that time. Amazon isn't saying they've changed their procedures. They're saying they should do nothing. You know, the answer on the causation issue, in part, is you take a look at the Bookwalter case. If you took a look at the Broussard case or even the Schulte case, they have a minimal duty of inquiry. They have a minimal duty of inquiry when there's red flags. And what are the red flags here? Red flags are the false declaration forms, the failure to have a Fish and Wildlife importation form 3177. These are classic red flags. And for Amazon to say we have no obligation whatsoever, all they had to do was ask for confirmation, certification that a 3177 form was done.
Can I ask you about that? I understood that the Fish and Wildlife Service allows importers to file a form 3177 electronically, and in fact encourages that. Let me just pause there. Do you contest that fact?
No.
So then let me ask you then, how is it that the absence of a physical form gives rise to an inference of knowledge on the part of Amazon, if it can very well be, in fact, it is encouraged to be, the fact that they're filed electronically? So why would there be an inference drawn that that's an indicium of fraud?
Great question. But it's not that alone. That's not the only indicia.
Yeah, but let's just pause on that. Why would that be an indicia?
If it were simply that, everything else.
Even in combination, why does that add an incremental
indicium of fraud? Because we submit that Amazon had a minimal duty of inquiry under the authorities, under a substantial factor test. And all they had to do, no different than the assurance of discontinuance in the Washington State AG settlement, all Amazon had to do was ask for confirmation, certification, that in fact, the form had been filed. But when you think about what Amazon has set up, and it's quite actually surprising, ship to us, we'll warehouse it, we'll advertise it, we'll market it, we'll sell it, we'll collect it, we'll handle customer compliance. But the compliance with the law is entirely on you, even when Amazon is faced with specific, definite knowledge that there's a problem in River City.
Now, Mr. Godfrey.
Yes, sir.
You specifically used the word surprising, I think.
Yes.
Was there anything that Amazon did here regarding the Chinese fur merchants which differed in any way from how Amazon treated other merchants. I'm interested in this because, for the obvious reason, this is a case which goes to the very heart of Amazon's business, right? This is not just the fur company.
Correct.
Yeah.
Short answer is yes. State AG of Washington in 2017 initiated an investigation because Amazon was selling products that had hazardous chemicals, hazardous to young children. State AG initiated the investigation, and Amazon, since May the 9th, 2019, has done something quite different. They have asked for certified tests of each of the products, and they've asked for notice when those products do not pass the certified test to be given to the state AG. Why? It's hazardous. It can kill kids. It can poison them. I mean, think about what Amazon's arguing. We're just the warehouser. We're just the distributor. We're just the marketer.
What was the Washington law that was at stake there? Was that an importation case?
No.
What was the putative violation that they were selling or allowing to be sold things that were?
It was Consumer Protection Act case.
So what I'm wondering is, and perhaps your adversary will have a view on this, is there a material distinction where an online marketplace could be held liable under laws that prohibit distribution or sales of, say, things that are toxic or dangerous to consumers, as opposed to holding them responsible for importation of goods?
There is clearly an academic difference, but at a practical level, there is no difference. First, in terms of the ability of Amazon to detect and stop the fraud here, it's easy. They did it in the state of Washington. So the question is there a legal difference?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer I would submit is no. Whether it's a consumer protection statute, whether it's an importation statute, it doesn't matter.
But causation and knowledge are fact-based inquiries. And so my question, counsel, is under your theory of knowledge and causation, wouldn't a company that, say, distributes, doesn't directly sell, they don't manufacture, but say they distribute medical, all types of medical supplies from all types of manufacturers, and their role is to receive the supplies that are ordered and deliver them to multiple providers. In the event one of those sellers is filing false claims with either insurance companies or, say, Medicare, billing fraudulently, overbilling for devices, that would put then any distributor in the chain responsible for that false billing. Under your theory of causation, how would that not expand it to that type of activity?
Well, first, it's not my theory of causation. It's the law as announced by various courts. If you look at footnote 3, page 18 of the district court opinion, the district court opinion rejects Amazon's argument that because it is not the importer, it can't be held liable. And it does so for the reasons that they have at least a minimal duty. If they know that a violation of the law is taking place, in this case, the import laws, they have a minimal duty.
If they know.
Right. And that goes back to knowledge.
So how do they know if the bills are sent electronically that the manufacturer or supplier of that product is overbilling?
On that alone, they wouldn't. It's the collection of facts that are alleged. What is the collection of facts that are alleged? Actual knowledge by virtue of the customs declaration form. You know, when I was younger, I had a blue-collar job, and part of the thing of blue-collar jobs, you have to put swap in the right area. It arrives at the warehouse saying children's clothes, polyester. But the invoice says furs. It's not very difficult to say polyester and children's clothes are not furs. Then, of course, you have lack of the form, which you should now say to yourself, well, wait a minute, if you have any oversight at all, given that it has a misdescription on the customs declaration form, which allows them to evade the tariffs and the inspection fee, I wonder what the 3177 file says. Then you have Mr. Henning, who put them on notice, showing how easy it is. Amazon provided the communications platform. They vouched for these products. They sold these products. They handled the customer complaints. So I agree with you, Your Honor, that if you look at in isolation the 3177, that alone wouldn't tell you. But it's the collection of facts that are alleged that tells you we have an open marketplace with no monitoring, no controls, no oversight, no different than the children's hazardous substances. So whether it's FERS.
So, Mr. Godfrey, let me just see, unless there are any further questions from the panel right now, we have kept you past your time. No, we appreciate that. We kept you up here. And you have still reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal, so don't go away. Mr. Gossett, we will hear from you for...
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you for the appellees.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. David Gossett for Defendant Amazon. The fraud at issue here was committed not by Amazon, but by third-party sellers of FERS. That fraud was complete before those FERS ever entered Amazon's warehouse, and Amazon neither had a legal duty nor any reason to check whether those sellers complied with federal tariff and import laws. The district court, crediting every well-pleaded allegation in the complaint, correctly held that Amazon neither violated nor conspired to violate the False Claims Act. That judgment should be affirmed. I have three main points this morning, unless the court directs me elsewhere. First, the False Claims Act is not a failure to police statute. Hennig's reverse false claims theory is fundamentally flawed because Amazon had no independent obligations under the customs or importation laws. Just as Amazon was not liable for third-party sellers' violations of the Plant Protection Act in last year's D.C. Circuit case, so too is it not liable for the third-party sellers' False Claims Act violations here. Second, Hennig seeks to impose liability based on Amazon's alleged failure to detect or prevent third-party sellers' misconduct after the government itself cleared those goods. But the second amended complaint does not plausibly allege that Amazon knew of or caused those third-party seller false claims. False Claims Act complaints are subject to Rule 9b, and Hennig needed to plead specifics and has utterly failed to do so. His second amended complaint contains some examples of third-party sellers committing customs fraud, but they do not suggest that Amazon knew of or caused that fraud. Third, Hennig's conspiracy claim fails because Hennig needs to allege an agreement among the conspirators to violate the False Claims Act and an overt act to support that agreement. But the complaint alleges only that Amazon provided standardized arm's-length services to third-party sellers for profit, the same business solutions agreement that was at issue in the D.C. Circuit's AFIS case last year. An ongoing business arrangement plus a generalized profit motive are insufficient as a matter of law to plead a False Claims Act conspiracy.
Counsel, assuming the allegations in the complaint were sufficient to allege knowledge, either actual knowledge or reckless disregard, what is your position as far as causation then?
Sure. I obviously don't agree with the premise, but I will get there later on. As to causation, I think it is also false. Causation under the False Claims Act is essentially proximate cause, not but-for causation. And this goes back to the Supreme Court's recent Twitter v. Tomney decision, where the court said, quote, "The concept of helping in the commission of a crime or a tort has never been boundless. That is because, if it were, aiding and abetting liability could sweep in innocent bystanders as well as those who gave only tangential assistance." So here, the theory of causation is that Amazon, after these third-party sellers imported products and sent them on and sold them, the third-party sellers are the sellers, to Hennig, Amazon somehow caused those third-party sellers to lie to the government. And there is no offering this open platform for open marketplace for third-party sellers to sell goods is no different than a shipping service, a payment processor, a distribution system. There is no limiting principle to causation in this instance.
Let me follow up just with one additional question. Has this court expressly adopted the proximate cause standard?
No, it hasn't, Your Honor. But no,
you would be asking this court to expressly adopt that and set law as far as what the proper standard is.
I don't think the court needs to expressly adopt that because I don't think it's any different from the position that my friend on the other side is advocating also. I mean, I think that I think this is a pretty simple case. I think that it's not a case in which the court needs to make new law, needs to make any broad pronouncements about what the law is in unrelated context, because the allegations fall so far short of demonstrating a False Claims Act.
Can I pause on that same point then? Are you suggesting that you would win even if the proper test for causation is but-for causation? Because if you suggest that we don't need to decide the standard, I would understand that normally to mean that you win under any articulation of that standard. What at least on causation, I understand that you also make other arguments that, for example, Amazon didn't have knowledge, and that would independently defeat the claim. But if still indulging in just Judge Kahn's hypothetical that there were adequate allegations of knowledge, just answer the question, I guess, of whether you think you would prevail under any theory of causation.
I do, Your Honor, though at that point, I think I do because of Rule 9b, not because that there wouldn't be a theoretical basis for but for. If there were but for causation and there was clear information that a specific sale was illegal importation was done because Amazon offered a marketplace for that sale, then but for causation might be met, even though that same seller could have sold that product on Etsy or eBay or something else. But here, at that point, you're looking at the very specific examples in the complaint, and that's where the complaint just falls apart. I mean, we pointed out in our brief, for example, that the Mr. Hennig really likes the example that's in paragraph 67 of the second amended complaint about $900 worth of furs that were imported with a declared value of $80. And says this is an example where Amazon, here's a real world example where this fraud happened that Amazon facilitated a False Claims Act going through. But that same transaction is the transaction that was in paragraph 108 of the first amended complaint, to which Mr. Hennig attached the document supporting that claim, and that's Exhibit 22 and 23, JA 309 to 312. And if you look at those files, you see that those furs never actually entered Amazon's possession. Those furs were shipped directly from China to Mr. Hennig in Alabama. You need to have a real example, and he doesn't.
I understand the argument you're making. What if we were to rely on that particular argument, though, I think we would be getting into somewhat new territory for our court about whether on ruling on a motion to dismiss on a second amended complaint, we are permitted to consider documents that were submitted only in conjunction with earlier versions of the complaint. So we'd be looking outside the four corners of the current complaint or any documents attached to it. Are you suggesting, I suppose, that your adversary is necessarily incorporating those documents by reference? That's why we could look at them?
Essentially, I am, Your Honor.
Or has it just become extrinsic? Might that be a good argument you could make on summary judgment? Because then you're asking us to look at particular evidence beyond the allegations.
One, Mr. Hennig doesn't dispute that the court appropriately looked at those documents, the district court or this court. So he doesn't dispute that those documents were before the court. The Second Circuit hasn't addressed this. This doesn't come up frequently, but what other courts have pointed out is that there's a great distinction between holding a plaintiff to the allegations in the first amended complaint, you can change your legal theory and such, versus documents attached to that legal complaint, which are facts that are in the record and that are already before the court. So that is one of the lines that other courts have held. And third, the courts who have confronted this have specifically thought it inappropriate for a plaintiff to be allowed to amend their complaint to state something that seems plausible when they themselves have documents that are inconsistent with that. So yes, to the extent the court needs to rule on that, it would be new law. But again, Mr. Hennig doesn't actually dispute that those documents are before this court.
Can I put to you the same question I put to Mr. Godfrey? Because I'm interested in the business model of your client. Is there any way in which Amazon treated the Chinese exporters here differently than it did other merchants?
No, Your Honor. These merchants are all, I mean, Amazon offers standardized services to third-party sellers. I've sold things on Amazon, and that made me a third-party seller on it. That's not on the record, obviously. But it's,
presumably you paid nothing, duties if they were... Presumably, you paid any duties that were owing on those.
I was selling something I already owed, something used.
And but you the declared point is that the product that you were selling accurately.
Yes. But the business, the Amazon offers completely standardized terms for third-party sellers. And those terms, among other things, remind them that they have to comply with the law. And that's it's not, they're not disclaiming that they're not trying to hide sort of themselves from it. They're just trying to remind people, we want you to sell things legally. I see that
they signed some sort of document to that effect. Is that right?
Yes. I believe that in signing up to be a seller, you have to sign on to the business services solutions agreement. That's not direct. That they signed it is not in the record, but they agree that the business solutions agreement, the standardized form, controls. I had one other point I wanted to make. I see my time's out, if that's okay.
Keep going.
Thank you. That's Mr. Godfrey focused on examples of drugs, weapons, the Washington State investigation of children's products that are dangerous. And those are fundamentally different than this. Those are examples where there is a product that is itself illegal, unsafe, et cetera. Here we are talking about paper fraud that happened before the products ever got to Amazon, that you cannot tell if something was imported legally or illegally by looking at the product. And their theory is this fiction that warehouse workers processing billions of packages are going to know that this package, these furs are illegal, whereas another fur is not. It's very different from a warehouse worker opening a box and seeing ammunition in it. That would be a very different case than one involving completely illegal products in which the third-party seller committed fraud before they ever got to Amazon. It's in the end no different than that. Whether the third-party seller paid their income taxes, how would Amazon even know? So if the court has no further questions.
No.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Mr. Godfrey, you have reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Point one, the fraud was not complete upon the falsification of the forms by the importers. It was complete upon the sale arranged by Amazon, the delivery. We wouldn't be here if Amazon were not the party responsible for the advertising, marketing, sale, collection, and splitting of the proceeds. Point two, causation. The test is substantial factor. Now, the district court modified that by saying that it had to be knowingly passed on. That's not part of the substantial factor test. But we go back to the fundamental question. None of this could take place. And when my learned colleague at the bar says, well, ammunition is different or whatever, he didn't tell you that they had different procedures in answer to your question, Your Honor. But the fact is, on the package itself, it says customs declaration form, children's clothes. And the case law does not accept the proposition that when the data is there and you have red flags, that you get to walk away and do nothing. There's a minimal duty of inquiry. Take a look at the Bookwater case, the Borsow case. Take a look at the Odom versus Southeast Eye Specialist case. Take a look at U.S. versus Taobo. Taobo, the fibers in these vests weren't working. They were supposed to be armored protective vests. And it was the policies and procedures that the court found gave rise to not only the knowledge, but the causal connection. Policies, procedures, and practices. The case law is settled. Next point. Mr. Hennig doesn't have any examples. Because in his case, they say, It was actually shipped. Not quite. We addressed this at page 5 of our reply brief with the citations. Or you could just go and look at pages JA 360 to 368. You'll see it goes both ways. But the point is, even the products that were shipped directly to Mr. Hennig were arranged for by Amazon. They were marketed by Amazon. The fees were collected by Amazon.
I'm sorry, just everything so if I can pause. Pages JA 360 to 368, you just said?
JA, yes.
Yeah.
That's in joint appendix.
Are they exhibits to the second amended complaint?
Yes, well, they're exhibits to the first amended complaint. Since they're talking about the first amended complaint.
Well, let me just ask you that. That's maybe a housekeeping question, but I would appreciate the clarity. One of the questions we were just talking about with your adversary was whether it would be appropriate for this court to consider exhibits that were attached to your first amended complaint in adjudicating now the motion to dismiss the second amended complaint. It sounded like you were directing our attention to some of those earlier exhibits. So, no,
that's right.
I don't really care what your answer is. I just want to know what the position of your client is. Are you taking the position that we may look at exhibits because they have effectively been incorporated by reference into the second complaint?
They were not incorporated. My position is twofold. Number one, the district court did not rely upon that.
Okay.
In which case,
should we, though?
And number two, I don't think you should, but it doesn't matter because they don't prove the point he's making.
Okay.
So as a matter of institutional law, if you will, this is not the case that really makes a difference.
Okay, that's fair. I think we have your argument. And there being no further questions, we thank both of the parties for, again, your traveling up here and for the very helpful oral arguments. We will take the case under advisement.